Thanks so much for tuning into Radical Philosophy. I'm your host, Beth Matthews. And we're going to be speaking to Chris Sitka, and this is part two of a two-part interview. Welcome back, Chris.
Oh, hi, Beth.
Thanks for coming back in again.
Yeah, that's all right.
And we'll start off where we left off last time, and we've been speaking about radical lesbian philosophy. So what issues were discussed?
Well, we formed our radical lesbian group, and probably before we formed it, while we were still part of Gay Liberation, women's group, we were discussing a number of issues. So one of them would have been how much we were influenced by women's liberation and gay liberation, and where we were more closely aligned. Obviously, we supported lesbian liberation, and actually that was a term that we adopted later. Lesbian liberation became a thing, and not just gay and lesbian liberation. But we talked about that, and of course that caused us to leave the gay lib in the sense that we no longer met in. They actually had a house where they used to. Someone paid the rent on it, and where they used to meet, which was pretty good at the time. We didn't have that. We just started meeting. We had a number of communal households in Fitzroy, two houses especially, which we had a number of lesbians living in each, and we were always at each other's place having discussions, and they were a bit like lesbian doss houses too. Sometimes you would have a lot of lesbians staying there. In the paper of the history I've written about the radical lesbians, I was glancing through it this morning, and Jenny mentioned they used to have six women in sleeping bags sleeping in their bedroom with them, you know, sometimes when something was happening. We would we'd get together. So we didn't have so much formal discussions. It basically went on all day and night. You know, we were very enthusiastic. We were very fired up about the idea of being radical lesbians, and we kept discussing what it means. And apart from which I talked a bit about in the last episode, being having revolutionary ideas of totally changing society and getting rid of patriarchy, capitalism, the military-industrial complex, as we called at the time, the whole thing. We also discussed personal issues, which were also political. For example, coming out was a big topic. If we were going to make lesbians visible and change the way we could move in the world, we needed to come out. And at the time, I would say most, you know, vast majority of lesbians never came out to their families, their friends, their work mates if they were at school or university or whatever. Coming out was a very, very dangerous thing to do. But we felt that we had to be at the forefront, and we had to, and that was also a big thing in gay liberation. Everybody should come out so that people would realise how many of us were out there. So we would challenge each other personally. You know, it was a very challenging sort of group where once you realised something was a political necessity, you would challenge each other to take action. And one of those was coming out to our families or wherever. So a lot of us were, you know, the members were students and that, but that was kind of easier to come out at university. I remember walking around Melbourne University with a T-shirt. There was no such thing as themed T-shirts at the time. They were just all plain. So I got a texter and I wrote on mine, I'd say scrawled, "I'm a lesbian." And then I would walk around. And that was quite a dangerous thing to do at the time, you know. You really had men, you know, following you around, like, you know, abusing you and things like that. But also we would, you know, go, okay, I'm going to go home and tell my mother I'm a lesbian. And there was this funny incident where Sharon decided, okay, I'm going to come out. And she rang her mother up and she said, you know, my friend Chris, well, she's a lesbian. So and then afterwards we had a go at her because we said, you didn't actually came out, you just outed Chris. But your mother was supposed to know that you were, which her mother did, you know, it was quite shocking for her mother. So, yeah, that was, you know, one. Coming out was a big thing, and not everyone who was in the group or hung out with us probably did come out. You could very well, if you had a job, you would probably lose your job in those days if you came out, or the persecution of you would be so huge you couldn't handle it. So it was, you know, but we were trying to create the sort of society which we have much more now in Australia, where people can openly be at work, school, whatever, but it wasn't like that then.
So how did you formulate your theories?
Like I said, we would sit around and talk. We read stuff. It was very hard to get anything. But in America, they were publishing a few things. There was a group called Radical Lesbians in America. And if you do a Google internet search, you will come across the American Radical Lesbian group. So somehow we would get their literature. And I don't know how we got it in their memory. You know, the Americans were starting to publish a few things that we could buy. When I first came out as a lesbian, I'd say it would be actually impossible to buy anything, any book, anything in a bookshop or publicly about lesbians. But somehow we got some of this literature and we'd read it. Also, three of our members who came and joined the gay women's group at Gay Lib, they'd been in England and they'd been part of the revolutionary left there. And there'd been some discussions there. So they came with some ideas and said, look, you know, we really want to go further into this, and got us talking and thinking about things and, you know, coming up with topics that we'd talk about. And we just thought, okay, we have to think, how do you have a relationship if you're a radical feminist lesbian, or how do you relate to your family? How do you relate to society? So we'd just develop these theories, and we had very challenging conversations with each other. It was a very robust time. I tell you, young people now, if they were in one of our discussions, they'd run out of the room crying probably, because you could really virtually attack someone and say, you just said something sexist, or you just said something, you know, that's what we called ideologically unsound was the words we used at the time. So you feared to utter something ideologically unsound. And for example, at the conference that we organised, the Radical Lesbian Conference at Sorrento in 1973, you can also Google that and some things will come up. Women gave various papers to discuss, and one was on bisexuality. And there was a lot of hostility to the bisexuality paper, because we were very much, bisexuality is a cop-out, you've got to be lesbian. And one of the reasons was because it was a way of sort of coming out but not really coming out. You would tell a lot of women, I think this still happens, would say to their mother or their parents, oh, I'm bisexual, and they would go, oh, that's shocking, but at least it wasn't totally shocking, because that you maybe their lovely daughter would still get married to a man and have children. So so we didn't like that concept, you know, you can't have your cake and eat it too, you have to come out fully. And and that's something that we'd been through, and we didn't like. So those women were, you know, you would have a very robust discussion, and it was, but that was how you created a new theory and a new philosophy. You didn't kind of sit back and be nicey-nice and let someone disagree with you. we thrashed it out, because it was a way of pushing our understanding of the world and ourselves into a new sphere, you know. It's an uncomfortable thing to do, and you get pushed to think anew, and often someone would, you know, come up with some idea that you found a bit confronting. But you just put up with it, and then you thought about it, and, you know, often later you'd come to understand it better. So,
well, that's exactly what philosophy is. And philosophy has to be debated, and people have to bring up different ideas, because if you haven't changed your mind lately, how do you know you still have one?
Mm.
You know, and I mean, you might have an idea in your head, but then, you know, somebody presents a different view and you think, well, that's right, I hadn't thought of it from that angle. And it's actually quite a big thing to admit that you were wrong.
Yeah.
You did have a certain mindset, but once you've increased your knowledge about a certain topic, you think, well, you know, what I thought was wrong, but, you know, now I've changed my mind. And I don't think that should be frowned upon. That is a really, really good thing to actually have that happening. So what happened to the radical lesbians?
Well, it was, you know, it was an incredibly active, dynamic group, and we organised the conference and we did a lot of actions and that, but it didn't actually last as a solid group with a, you know, that identity, radical lesbian group. Probably only lasted for a couple of years because we all got involved in different actions. Like I said, we were very involved in women's liberation, and we were doing, as well as our lesbian activism, we were doing women's activism. For example, at the first conference we had, we came up with the idea of setting up a women's refuge for women who are, you know, being abused in relationships, to have somewhere to go. Actually, initially we wanted to set it up for young women, because one of our members was very involved in supporting young women who were being locked up at the Abbotsford's convent for having become accidentally pregnant. So that's what you did. You locked them up in a little prison and put them to work in the laundry. So one of our members was, who I lived with, we used to escape young women from there, and we wanted to have somewhere to send them. We had to find somewhere for them to stay and that. But we realised it was too politically difficult to start a group of lesbians, to start a group for young women, because people had pretty nasty ideas about what a lesbian was. We were akin to the devil. We had horns growing out of our heads, and we had hairy legs and terrible things. So, you know, people found us very shocking and confrontational, especially because we weren't dressed in feminine ways. And so, yeah, we came up with this idea of the women's refuge that I will say, in, you know, the first women's refuge in Melbourne was, the idea came out of the Radical Lesbian Conference. And then a group was formed to, which included some heterosexual women, but was pretty heavily membered by lesbians. And so we set up, you know, we started that process. And we were involved in women's theatre group started, and women were involved in that, and, you know, various things. So our energies were going in all different directions. The other thing, big thing that came out of that radical lesbian group was the idea to start a women's land. So one of our members had written the first lesbian novel published in Australia, and she earned the huge sum of money, $5,000, that was immense at the time, and she decided she would buy some land. Anyway, she found this perfect piece of land, but it cost a bit more. I think it was $10,000. And so she came back to the group and said, let's form a women's land group, and we all went up there in this great expedition. And by this time, a little lesbian share house had started in Sydney, and we stopped there. So we decided to buy this land and call it women's land. And many of us envisaged we were going to, patriarchy was too to be fixed at the time. That's how we said, and we would just leave it behind and create a new lesbian feminist world, and women would be attracted from all over to the world to this amazing new way of living where all the cultural values were radical feminist and radical lesbian. So that was one of the projects. But, you know, as I say, women were going up to the women's land. They were working on the women's refuge and a number of other things. So we stopped being such a coherent group. But we've always, you know, most, especially the core women, have maintained contact over the years. of course, a few of our members no longer here on the planet. But we sort of spread out, and we also, you know, were working in that whole cultural establishment thing. So it was pretty busy time for us in our 20s and 30s. And that's what happened to the group. I would say it still exists in the stratosphere, influencing us all.
And if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Radical Philosophy on Radio 3CR, 855 on your AM dial. And I'm speaking with Chris Sitker about the philosophy of radical lesbians. Now, my next question, I think you've partly answered, and did you want to add any more to this? So how did society react, families, work and media?
Well, you know, pretty hostile. I would say, look, in my own case, my mother accepted that I was a lesbian, but she was never happy about it. But some families of radical lesbian members rejected them. They lost, you know, touch and friendship with their families. A number of women had been in what we call compulsory heterosexual relationships and had had children. So those women, if the husbands took them to court, they usually lost custody of their children. So we had women like that who, you know, lost touch with their, you know, lost their children. That's a pretty major consequence. But and the media would write, unfortunately, I don't have copies of any of this, except something that I do have copies of something that was written about the women's land, which was absolutely insane what the media wrote about us. You know, really crazy things like, you know, we swung around on vines with knives ready to castrate men, and it was that was very hostile. And and women, some women lost their jobs. There was some, you know, pretty well publicised incidents of that in the 70s. But also there was physical violence. I remember this wasn't in Australia, but I went and lived in a lesbian squat in London, and we were attacked almost on a daily basis by gangs of men who would throw burning rags through the letterboxes like they have in England. They would attack women on the way home. We used to have to form little groups to take women to the bus stop when they were going to work, especially if they're coming home at night. We'd have to meet them. When we had a dance, we all had to leave together because there were actual gangs of men who were targeting us. And there are instances of terrible attacks like that in Australia as well. I got thrown out of we had a lesbian household. We got thrown out of our rental because some yobbos had come and spray painted lesbian on the front of the house. So there was, a lot of violence and potential violence, and you walked around with your radar, pretty waiting for someone to attack you if you were holding hands in public. That had never been done. Whenever I see young women walking around, holding hands, being affectionate, I say, you can do that because of the radical lesbian group, and we took the punches for you.
Yeah, for sure. So what was your relationship like with Women's Lib and Gay Lib?
Well, like I said, we sort of supported Gay Lib, and some of the women in the gay women's group stayed in Gay Lib and wanted to work with the men. And, of course, we thought they were too sexist for us. We had very high standards at the time. But I've met some of those guys in later time, and I realise, oh, they're not as sexist as, you know, a lot of men around now. So they had a concept of liberation and women's. They understood what women's liberation was about, which I don't think many people do now. The queer society, community, whatever it is, they're much more about assimilation, living like heterosexuals, getting married, having children. You know, they... and less about total social change. And with women's liberation, it was a little bit There was some of the older women did feel threatened because they felt we were giving them a bad name, which we were, because lesbians were a bad name to be had, you know. So, but in and so there was a bit of tension, but I don't remember too much. And I'm still, you know, in subsequent decades, I've been very friendly with some of those older straight women who feel a sisterhood with me as a women's liberationist and don't hold a grudge about that we gave them a bad name back in the 70s. I don't think we've got much time left, so I'd just like to talk a bit about how women can find out more about the radical lesbians or non-women if they want.
Yeah, great.
So I wrote a paper called The History of Radical Lesbians, and it's quite long, and I published that and all the papers that were presented at the conference. And you can find that online if you look for it. It's called Radical Lesbian History, or if you Google the Melbourne Radical Lesbian Conference in Sorrento, there's interesting stuff there. There's things in the Gay and Lesbian Archives here. I believe they're called the Queer Archives now, and the Women's Liberation Archives. That are held by Melbourne Uni. And I'd advise reading my paper because it's a very good summary. It was written in 1988, so it was only 15 years after. When I read it, I realise I remembered a lot more then than I do now.
Well, I must say you're quite a brilliant writer, Chris, and I think your writing even managed to go to the States. I remember there was a couple of American women who said, oh, Chris Sicker, we've read some of her stuff.
Yes, I used to write a lot of theory because, you know, that's what the radical lesbians did. We created new theory, new ways of seeing the world, so new philosophy. And I used to write a lot of articles, so I wrote in almost every lesbian newsletter. We had a lot of lesbian newsletters and magazines, by the way, and there were some in America and England, and so I've had things published throughout the Western world that I wrote, you know, that mostly based on, you know, my lesbian ideas. We used to have in the 80s these things called ovulas, which were like little mini conferences where we would all present papers and talk about theory, and we kept developing this idea. So I guess, you know, the radical lesbians as a tight group sort of spread out, but we were all, you know, part of a whole lot of different ways of pushing a lesbian view of the world out there. And yeah, so have a look around and see what you can find. A lot of what I wrote was pre-internet, so it's not necessarily all in the AI mind yet.
No, and look, just on a recent sort of note, do you want to give a plug for the Leaping Lesbian Archives? Is that what it's called?
Yes, that's right. So some of us feel that knowledge of the, you know, the amazing things that we did in our lifetime of creating a new way of lesbian philosophy, view of the world, activities. It was really immense, and it's becoming, you know, invisible again, and the women who created us all starting to fall off the perch. So a group of women have had this idea of organising an actual, like, art or museum archival exhibition called Lesbians Leap from the Archives, and it's going to be on for, I think, 4 weeks starting from October the 8th, which is International Lesbian Day this year, 2026. So look out for it. You can come to look through the exhibition, which will be the history of lesbian activism. I think it's from 1970 to the year 2000. Is its time frame. And so you'll see me there, you'll see an interview with me there, you'll see a lot of artefacts of the time. So I really suggest Lesbians Leap from the Archives, look for it, go there, you will see our herstory.
Right, so because that's something modern, can people Google that? And
I think so.
Yes.
I guess so, yeah. There's a Facebook group or whatever. Yeah, and there will be publicity. So
yep.
It's in Melbourne, though. You've got to come to Melbourne.
Oh, of course. That's where it's all happening, in Melbourne. That's why I left Sydney to come to Melbourne, because it's all happening here.
Yeah.
Yes. Great. Well, thanks very much for that. Thanks for coming onto the program.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. I'm glad to get some of this story out so that we are remembered after we've fallen off the perch.
Yeah, well, hopefully that won't be
too soon.
Too soon for you or me, Chris.
Okay, I'm sticking around.
Yeah, so am I. Oh, so I've been speaking with Chris Sicker about history of radical lesbian feminism. And this is part two of a two-part interview. Thanks very much for tuning in today, and there you have it.